Welcome to the Self-Worth Safari podcast, a series where we talk about how we apply self-worth to living and working. Today, I'm joined by John Perry from University of Southampton. John and I are going to be talking about self-worth in student life, how self-worth applies in the life of students. John is Principal Teaching Fellow in healthcare communication at University of Southampton. He's also a freelance coach and counsellor and therapist with a particular interest in psychological resilience, a topic that I'm sure we'll be coming to shortly. John, you're very welcome.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Can you tell us a bit about the day job, just to tell us a little bit about your day-to-day work with students?
Yeah, of course. So the really two aspects to the day job. One is teaching. So I teach healthcare communication. So I teach communication skills, counselling skills, what used to be known as either soft skills or bedside manner, as well as teaching medical students how to deliver very difficult news, how to break significant news, how to respond to patients who might be aggressive or volatile or very anxious, very depressed, and so on. So that's something I do for all years of the medical school curriculum, a combination of group work and lectures and lots of work with role players, simulated patients. And alongside that, I am one of the pastoral tutors. So I'm a senior tutor, which means that students in crisis can contact me. And I can either see if I can help with their presenting problems, or I can signpost them in a direction of more specialist help.
So, what kind of issues do you see? You know, you mentioned students in crisis. What are the typical crises these days?
Some of it is life stuff. So, stuff that just happens. So, bereavement, relationship breakdowns, problems with landlords, all those sorts of stuff. But increasingly, the most significant thing, I think, in the context of self-worth is students who have that sense that in order to be worthwhile, they have to be excelling at everything. Medical students are an untypical group in that typically they have been tops of their class and they've come with straight A's and they have no experience of even getting a B. So the idea that they may not be top of the class, in fact, they may be struggling is something entirely out of their kind of experience. And so helping students to cope with the reality that in a year group of 240, 239 of them are not going to be the top student.
Wow.
And in fact, 120 of them are going to be doing below average. That's a new way of thinking for a lot of them. And it has a big impact.
Right. And what impact does it have? Where does that impact show up?
Well, I think in feelings of reduce self-worth and feelings of being a failure. I say it's not uncommon, particularly around kind of October time when students start getting their first assessments, for students to knock on my door and to say, you know, I've just got a B for my first assessment. How on earth am I going to tell my parents?
Wow.
And I always say, well, tell them you've got a B and invite them to be pleased for you. It's not a bad first grade.
And are they still telling the parents at that point? Is the parental pressure that significant?
It's a very significant thing for a lot of students, not for all students, but a lot of students are subject, I think, probably to more pressure from home than they are from the university. On top of which, of course, they then add pressure from themselves.
Gosh, that's a lot of pressure.
It is, and I think particularly because a lot of them will come from very high-achieving families. A lot of medical students have parents who are doctors. They've grown up with the idea that they're going to be a doctor from a very early age. I mean, one of the questions I like to ask students is, how old were you when you first thought you might like to be a doctor? And a very typical response is, well, it was always assumed I would be. Mom and Dad are both doctors.
Right. Okay, so this high achieving background, this this context, if you like, of performance, they've been soaked in that. They've grown up with that right through the schooling.
Yeah, and again, like with a lot of courses that recruit people who need highest grades to get onto the courses, a significant number come from independent schools, from very aspirational, very target driven independent schools where the whole focus of their schooling has been, you know, unless you're the top student, you're failing. And they come with all of that baggage too.
Mm. Now, there'll be people listening to our conversation who will probably think, well, why not? You know, performance is a good thing, isn't it? I mean, we need our young people to excel. How do you deal with that topic?
Well, performance is important, but I don't think we ever have to invest our sense of being worthwhile in our performance. And for me, that's the crucial thing. And that's one of the things I really took from your self-worth safari, is the difference between self-esteem and self-worth. Mm. I think performance is a good way of boosting our self-esteem, but actually we don't need to relate performance to our sense of self-worth. Our sense that we're born okay, we're born worthwhile, we're born with fundamental worth and value, and no one ever opens us up and takes those qualities away. They're with us always, and we don't need to earn them. They're just part of what comes along with being human being. Mm. You know, human beings are worthwhile. They have innate worth and value, and we don't ever need to put that sense of being worthwhile on the line when we're taking assessments. Because if we do, we're actually likely to become very stressed if we don't feel we're doing as well as we hoped. Mm-hmm. And then our performance is going to tail off even more so.
Right. How do students respond to that distinction?
Interestingly, quite emotionally very often. It's what one of the sessions that I do very early on in their course, in fact, in their first few weeks, is a session where I invite everybody to close their eyes and imagine that they're looking down on themselves as a newborn child lying in a cot. And to get a really strong sense that as a newborn child lying in a cot, they have innate worth and value. They are worthwhile. They are valuable. And they haven't done anything. They just are. And actually, they always will be. And they don't need to be top of the class to be valuable because they were born valuable. They don't need to be in the highest quartile to be worthwhile because they were born worthwhile. Wow. And to try to separate out their performance from their innate worth. And some will say at the end of it, you know, I get a queue of students very often lining up to say, that's the first time I've ever heard that. It's the direct opposite message to everything I got from home, from my school, from careers tutors, which is you have to earn being worthwhile. So yeah. Turning that on its head is quite an emotional thing for some people.
Yeah. I can still see the shining eyes of one young lady who approached me after a seminar session. Saying exactly the same thing. It was obvious that, as she put it, she had never heard that before. Mm. Isn't it extraordinary that we have young people at 18, 19, 20, 21 who have never heard
Absolutely.
That they're unconditionally worthwhile, that actually, that their worth is not dependent on their performance.
Sure, and I think it ties in with another set of really quite irrational beliefs, which is that somehow they need to be perfect from day one. Which is, if you think about it, it would be weird if you were perfect on day one of a 5-year degree, because what would you do for the rest of the 5 years? They've kind of got this sense that that it's not okay to be a work in progress. And so, again, one of my emphases is that we are all of us works in progress. You know, as old as I am, I fully intend to be a better lecturer next year than I am this year. But that doesn't mean I don't have innate worth and value while I'm this work in progress.
Super. Now, I still remember our conversation about a year ago, our first conversation, I think, which I found so shocking at the time. To remind you, I was about a year or so into this journey. I had been conscious of young people when writing the book, but you contacted me a little bit out of the blue, I think from a mailer or something, and you began to talk to me about the phenomenon of student suicide and self-harm, which for me, I mean, I was, it was one of the most shocking conversations and enlightening conversations of the year. Can you say a bit about that? Just to recap for me some of what's going on there.
Yeah, I mean, typically it's been around about 100 students take their lives every year in the UK. And although causes are, you know, there are many factors. There is a relationship between exam performance and suicide risk. And again, it is people who have overly invested their sense of being worthwhile and having a purposeful life in being successful in exams. And for the most part, I think universities are very good at being reactive to students in distress. So when students signal they're in distress, they universities tend to respond very well. What they're not so well at doing is being proactive, which is actually letting students know before they go anywhere near exams that they're absolutely fine whether they pass those exams or they don't. Mm-hmm. And really getting that message in there. You know, you don't have to actually be a doctor to be okay, to be worthwhile. There are plenty of people who are not doctors who lead good, purposeful, happy lives. And to really get people to think this through, because, you know, for me, it's just such a tragedy. It's such a huge waste of talent. But also just a kind of a, you know, suicide is a permanent solution to a temporary problem. If you've got to retake a year of university, that's a 1 year commitment. That's all that it is. And suicide is a permanent solution to what's a very temporary problem. One of the things that I like to do with the students that get referred to me because they are going to have to resit a year is to get them to imagine that rather than being 20 years old, they're 60 years old and they're looking back on a long, successful career as a doctor. And from this position, to get a strong sense of how much it matters that they repeated a year of their training. Mm. And what they will always say is, it just doesn't matter.
Yeah.
It just doesn't matter. In a moment, it can feel huge. But from a different perspective, it just won't matter. Mm.
And it's so perspective is absolutely important here.
Absolutely.
How else do you help people to, or young people in this case, to restore perspective?
For me, it's very important to embody it, because in my experience, unless you activate the felt sense, mm-hmm. then actually whatever counseling or coaching work you're doing, it's just cerebral. They're just thinking it through, but they're not really feeling it. And so one of the things I like to do is to get them to sit in one chair. And in that chair, it's a complete disaster to have failed their exams and to have to repeat the year. It's just wretched. It's just a disaster. And to really embody that sense of just how terrible that feels. But then in another chair, to sit in that chair and actually they've decided, they've made that choice that they're going to make the very best of the next year. They are repeating the year, but they're going to do it with a point of view that actually this is a positive. I can learn stuff that I potentially wouldn't learn unless I was repeating the year. I could end up a better doctor because of this year. This could end up a very positive thing. And to get a real strong sense of how it feels to be sitting in that chair. And then to really emphasize choice. You know, the student can choose which chair to sit in. They can choose to sit in the wretched chair. And they can choose to sit in the, I can take some positives from this chair. And ultimately they are choosing.
Indeed, indeed. Now, we will in this series be talking to people who are working with younger students at second level and even at primary level. Because we know from our own research at Selfworth Academy that these problems start very, very, very early. I used to think sort of 10 to 12. I'm now hearing it's more like 7 to 10. Sure. What message would you give to the parent of a secondary school student or even a primary school student around performance and around self-worth?
I think the key message for me for parents is to separate out praise from performance. So a very typical situation is a child might come home with a report, which is pretty good. And the parents will say, I'm so proud of you because of this report. And it's a little bit scary because what the child takes from that is, but if the next report isn't quite so good, will you stop being proud of me? Whereas actually, if they can learn just to put a full stop in between those two statements, I'm really proud of you, full stop. And by the way, great report. Right. So you don't link the two. You don't make one conditional on the other.
Superb. Superb. Is that back to unconditional appreciation again?
Well, absolutely. Because are you going to cease being proud of them if they have a bad year?
Well, alas, of course, in some cases, the answer is yes.
Indeed. In many people's experience, it is.
Yeah. To what extent do you think that some parents might be seeking their own validation and their own self-esteem through the lives of their, through living vicariously through the lives of their children?
Yes, absolutely. I think it's a particular common, a particular problem, say, in medicine, where so many medical students have parents who are doctors and their role in life very much is to be the trophy child. Their role in life is very much to be the young person that their parents talk about at dinner parties with pride. And that carries a huge amount, that's a huge burden for them to carry. It's not unique to academic context. It's something I used to see when I used to go and watch my boys playing rugby, and there were so many fathers yelling at their kids to get stuck in on the rugby pitch, and it was quite clear from their body language they would rather be anywhere but on a rugby pitch right now. But also from their body language, very clear they had a sense of letting their parents down, letting their father down, particularly being a disappointment, not being the kind of person that the father wanted, and not being good enough. And it's quite shocking, really. It's rather like, I mean, another more extreme version of that, one of the saddest things I ever saw was when my children have grown up now, and I'm now a granddad, but when they were very young and I used to take them to playgroup, watching parents or other carers pick up kids and put all of the work that they've created during that playgroup session in the bin in front of the child. Just mindfully awful. As if to say, what you've produced has no value at all. And I think for me, this illustrates both sides of the coin. And we need to recognize the value of what young people produce.
Yes.
Particularly where they've committed themselves to it. But not make their worthwhileness dependent upon the work that they produce.
Well, that's the core of your message, isn't it? To put the full stop into the sentence.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I really love that. Okay, so we've talked a little bit about the messages you'd like to give to younger kids, or more likely the parents of younger kids. How do you see the future, John? You're watching things evolve right now, of course. Student life right now has just got that extra bit more complicated, that extra bit harder. It was already pretty hard for the young. I think most of us acknowledge that. What do you see happening in the years ahead?
I think one of the trends that's very noticeable is students self-diagnosing with mental health problems. And it's a double-edged sword here, because on the one hand, it's a very positive thing that students who are struggling can be upfront about that, and that people talk openly about mental health and the challenges there. The downside of it, though, I don't think has been acknowledged enough, and it's very significant. So even just 5 years ago, students would knock on my door and say, I've come to see you because I'm really quite worried about my forthcoming exams. Now they're going to knock on the door and say, I've come to see you because I have exam anxiety.
Right.
They've diagnosed themselves, and they are now talking about something which is fixed. I have it, in the same way that they might come and say, I have size 9 feet, or I have brown eyes.
Yeah.
And my task really is to turn it from a noun, something which is fixed. I have anxiety, something as if you could put it in a wheelbarrow and carry it around. I bought my anxiety to show you.
On their shoulders.
That's right. Well, yeah. And to turn it back into a process. You know, anxiety, actually, we can look at as a verb rather than a noun.
Right.
So you're currently generating these feelings. You don't have them, but you're generating them. It's a different way of thinking about it. And then to actually see if we can actually change it further and say, well, currently, not forever, but currently, so it's temporary, a part of you, not all of you, but a part of you, is worrying about your exams, worrying, not anxiety. Mm-hmm. And if you can learn to talk in these ways, what I find with students is that things become much more manageable. They arrive saying, I have anxiety, and they leave thinking, a part of me is currently, just for the time being, worrying about my exams. Whereas right. another part of me is really looking forward to the opportunity to show what I know. So this is one of the things I think is going to be a huge thing, not just among students, but in the general population, trying to get out of the habit of diagnosis, where what we're talking about is life's problems.
Yeah. And I am not the label, eh? I
mean, well, absolutely.
This is the whole point. I am not my label.
Absolutely. So people having either applying a label to themselves, or having it applied from overworked GPs or others, and then somehow living that label out.
Living the label.
And I think the other thing I'd say is a lot of well-meaning but not best-trained counsellors can actually have a negative impact too. So a very common response to if a student goes to see a counsellor and says, I've come to see you because I've failed my exams, and the counsellor will say, well, how does that make you feel? Then they're likely to say, wretched, absolutely wretched. And they've made the person worse. And they've dug down into those negative feelings. Where if the counselor is a little bit more attuned to notions of empowerment, then actually you can get into the habit of saying, well, I'm sorry to hear that. That must be really disappointing. And how do you choose to respond? Now, the question, how do you choose to respond, is letting the person know some really important things. One is that they chose their response and other responses were available. And the other thing is, if it's not working for them, they could choose differently. Mm-hmm. So in my experience, what a lot of students will say then is, well, up to now, I've chosen to stay in bed till noon, mope around and feel sorry for myself. And you say, well, how's that worked for you? Well, it hasn't really. How else might you respond? I can probably contact my tutors and work out some extra revision sessions and maybe see if I can do better next time. Great response.
Yeah, very empowering as well. We've talked about the future. We've talked about what we'd like to see younger kids learn. And I think we're very aligned on that one. That's probably what has brought us together in the first place. What else should we be talking about around self-worth, around how people value themselves? You know, if you had a magic wand, the magic wand, if you could, you know, in our strange moment, if you could wave that pen and go, ta-da, Harry Potter, like, what would you do? How would you use it?
I think one of the shifts that you talk about in the self-worth safari that really struck home for me is the difference between being interesting and being interested. And I think a lot of students who struggle, but people generally who struggle with self-worth, are a little bit obsessed with trying to be interesting.
Interesting. Yeah.
And so what that means is they, could you just excuse me 1 second? I'll be
no
one
problem. Second. No problem. What John is talking about is the shift in the book between interested and interesting. So self-esteem, as I think he was about to say, leads people to try to be interesting and to be preoccupied with being interesting. Whereas if when we have self-worth, we've ticked that box, there is no need to be pouring all that energy. So we're now free to be interested.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's very... It's such an important point, because a lot of the students, I think, who struggle socially, it's because they don't get that. Because their self-worth foundation is so shaky, they feel obliged to be interesting all the time. Therefore, they talk too much, they hog conversations, they keep moving the agenda onto themselves, trying to be interesting. And the ironic thing is, they make a far less good impression than if they were interested in the other people that they're meeting with.
Very good. John, it's been a pleasure talking. Very enlightening as ever, very empowering as ever. If anyone is listening, John also does talks on these topics, at least in normal times. They're probably Zoom sessions now, like the rest of us. And his contact details will be in the text that accompanies this. John, thanks ever so much for joining
us
today. And wish you well in your continued work with empowering students, and particularly in protecting their resilience in these very, very challenging times.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Have a good day. Bye for now.
Cheers.